This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the concept that taking medicines for an illness is like digging a well when thirsty. Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socioeconomics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chandler, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this issue, we examine habits and addictions at work. Dr. Kelly Bullard, Bay Area trauma surgeon.
As a trauma surgeon, I see probably the worst implications.
Dr. Andrew Parker, psychologist in the Employee Assistance Program at UCSF.
3/4 of people who actively abuse some kind of substance, alcohol or drugs, are employed.
And Ms. Deborah Woodley from the Peer Assistance Program at a major transit agency in the Bay Area.
By the time it's showing up in the workplace, it's pretty severe.
First, the medical news. On June 19th, Brazil passed a zero-tolerance law for drivers with any measurable content of alcohol in their blood. Dr. Mirtha Roses, director of the Pan American Health Organization, praised Brazil and congratulated President Lula. She says the new law sets an example and represents a true model for the Americas to follow with regards to road safety and the prevention of deaths and injuries. Severe penalties have been enacted for those not adhering to the new limits. The effects of the new law have been noticed immediately. The law also sets strong restrictions on alcohol advertising. All establishments that sell alcoholic products will have to prominently place warnings stating that it is a crime to drink and drive. Dr. Roses indicated in her congratulatory letter to President Lula, between 20% and 50% of all accidents in transit are linked to alcohol. In Brazil alone, the resulting number of fatalities is 35,000 annually. Dr. Roses admits that precisely because the new legislation promotes behavioral change, it will be opposed by those who feel that their interests are being threatened. She says the same happened with legislation on tobacco control, and those voices were silenced. On August 4th, the World Health Organization issued new guidelines aimed at reducing preventable deaths by tuberculosis in HIV-positive drug users. People living with HIV are up to 50 times more likely to develop TB in their lifetimes. In 2006, 231,000 people died with HIV and TB. Drug users who are HIV positive face stigma, discrimination, and barriers to accessing life-saving treatments. Improving access to antiretroviral drugs and to isoniazid for intravenous drug users living with HIV is one avenue. Isoniazid preventive therapy significantly reduces the risk of developing tuberculosis disease. These are the first recommendations to actively include tuberculosis and HIV care within the context of support to drug users. Even where isoniazid preventive therapy is available, healthcare and outreach workers face major challenges in delivering full care to drug users who are often marginalized by homelessness, poverty, imprisonment, and by public and political hostility. These factors contribute to the transmission of both HIV and TB, and at the same time are barriers to TB, HIV, and drug dependence treatment. A study done by Dr. Wei Yu Sun and others, published in the International Journal of Occupational and Environmental Health, assessed burnout symptoms in 1,100 nurses in the People's Republic of China using the Maslach Burnout Inventory. Factors such as emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, and the sense of personal accomplishment were examined. The results indicate that the jobs that were burnout prone had one thing in common: overload. Too many patients and not enough time to adequately serve their needs. The clinic setting was worse than the hospital, and obstetrics was worse than surgery. The nurses who were the least likely to experience burnout symptoms were the ones who had worked more than 20 years. The report concludes with recommendations to improve physical features of the clinics, to provide social and public health support systems, and to offer new nurses stress management skills training. A study appearing in the July 2nd issue of the open access journal Public Library of Science 1 found that the simple relaxation response can alter the expression of genes. This may be the first comprehensive study of the mind's effects on gene expression. The study assessed gene expression patterns in 19 long-term practitioners of different relaxation response techniques and 19 individuals who had never engaged in such practices. The second phase of the study involved an 8-week relaxation training program for the non-practitioners. Each phase of the study showed that the relaxation response alters the expression of genes involved in inflammation, programmed cell death, and the body's handling of free radicals. The relaxation response can be brought about by such practices as meditation, deep breathing, and prayer. Previous studies have shown these practices to alleviate anxiety, heart arrhythmias, high blood pressure, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Kelly Bullard is a trauma surgeon on the east side of the San Francisco Bay. She shared her perspective about the role of habits and addictions in trauma and violence. Welcome to Naging Now, Dr. Bullard.
Thank you. You know, as a trauma surgeon, I see kind of the worst outcomes of what can happen when people have been using both drugs and alcohol and they become involved in high-risk behavior. We oftentimes see up to 80 to 85% trauma victims coming in per day who have had a substance on board. There have been several times when the fact that people were under the influence of either drugs or alcohol, the severity of the injuries they sustained are much, much worse because of the inability to sort of protect themselves once the actual injury occurring event starts.
What's the most common substance that people have on board?
Alcohol. We deal with a pretty large population for drug use in our inner city hospital, but you know, most of the time with car crashes and even some of the violent injuries that occur, alcohol is one of the primary substances that the patients have on board.
And what's the most common problem? Is it violence? Is it motor vehicle accidents? Is it intentional, unintentional?
A lot of it's violent. You know, I think that that also depends on where you are, because other places that I've practiced where the violent injury rate wasn't as high, which is in many parts of America, the violent injury rate is less than 20% in most trauma hospitals, whereas in our trauma hospital it's closer to 30-35% for violent injury. But most hospitals have a much higher blunt injury ratio, and when that happens, the alcohol's resulting from car crashes or motorcycle crashes or oftentimes pedestrians being struck by automobiles. We deal with a patient population that does have a higher incidence of penetrating injury or violence-related injury. All of those things, though, are byproducts of not being able to stop the escalation of the effects of the drugs and the alcohol, so not having that restraint, whether it's driving too fast or driving recklessly, or getting into an altercation or getting into a situation where you're ramping up a violent situation. The underlying cause is the fact that there's not that level of reasonable restraint, not that level of being able to step back and go, whoa, what am I getting myself into?
Do you have any thoughts about why? I mean, what about our individual priorities and what about our societal priorities is contributing to this massive problem?
You know, if you look at the patients that end up in the emergency room that have drugs and alcohol on board, part of that is denial. One of the hard things about substances is that you lose that restraint I referred to earlier. You lose your ability to really have two sides of the coin as far as judgment goes. So therefore, you get into situations where you don't have the ability to step out and kind of de-escalate or slow down the process. You don't have the ability to pull off the road when you're driving drunk. You're in denial. You think, well, I'm fine. I really am fine, and I can do it. And having been a teenager and having, you know, imbibed alcohol from social situations back then, I myself personally know, at least from a very mild standpoint, how that can be, that you lose those inhibitions and you lose that ability to then have rational thought step in. I think it's part of that whole cycle of the more you get into the drugs and the alcohol, the less you are able to pull back and then have another option that you give yourself. It sets you up for very high risk possibilities. With the violence especially, when you get more than one individual together and they neither one have any restraint, then that's the perfect storm. If there's any element of disagreement to people who are under the influence of drugs, especially under the influence of something that may be an excitatory drug like cocaine or crystal meth, those folks can go into a rage and then have absolutely no restraint and do things they would never dream of doing if they had access to their rational side. They're not really being who they would be otherwise with the drugs and the alcohol on board.
Well, clearly, judgment is impaired.
Yeah.
You know, you see the end trauma, the blood, the guts that gets spilled. But do you think that people just don't think ahead, or they are not thinking about what could happen, or they just don't care? Do you have any insight into that?
I don't think that people don't care because, I mean, obviously most people, you sit down and you ask them in a non-inebriated state, if you ask them, would you like to have your leg broken? They would say no. I don't think that that connection really is real for most people until it happens. For an 18-year-old to go to a party and drink the way all their other friends are drinking, it never even crosses their mind, or it's never a reality for them that they could crash their car and end up in a vegetative state. And I see that on a regular basis, which is really tragic for us and for the families, for their parents. I think one of the most inspiring programs I've seen recently that's actually addressed substance abuse with teenagers, at least, is the program that they're doing in the high schools now, where they simulate a crash and they have the high school students participate in this scenario. They go to the extent of, they have sort of the crash scene at the high school, and then they take the high schoolers that were playing the roles of the people in the crash, and they take them to different area hospitals. I know the last few years we've participated in this, and so on this particular day every spring, we'll have what are to us mock traumas, but to the high schoolers, they're actually playing out the role of what would happen if they were to go to a party, get drunk, and start driving and crash the car with all of their friends in it. Some of the kids in the scenario die. Some of them end up paralyzed. It sort of translates that experience of kind of what they typically do on a Friday night into the reality of what could happen. And I think part of that re-education process needs to be with kids that are getting into alcohol and drugs, especially early on. Now, unfortunately, especially with the patient population I deal with, it's gone from casual social use of drugs and alcohol to dependent use. And I think that that's a much, much harder situation to deal with because, you know, the decision-making to, well, do I want to drink tonight or not, has turned into a more addictive process, which is, you know, another barrier to then try and help the patient through once they do, if they survive, and once they do survive, where do we go from here? The American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma has done a lot of work recently in urging trauma centers to work on drug rehab and alcohol rehab with patients that come in. And I think that that's one of the most encouraging things that I've seen from a national level happen for people who maybe are already in the addictive process and have other things to deal with other than recovering from their injuries.
I think that is very important, absolutely. Do you see people come in multiple times? Do you see repeat offenders?
There's a huge amount of recidivism. I mean, anytime a patient comes back in with violent injury and or multiple car crashes or high-risk behavior, we call it recidivism. And especially in people who are addicted to drugs and alcohol, we'll see them time and time again. And eventually they'll come in and they won't ever go out, which is the tragic part.
You mean they'll die?
Right. They'll have an injury to the degree where they can't leave. I mean, I've even recently seen patients who had been there 2 and 3 times prior with violent injury and come in with being completely paralyzed so that they're now in a skilled nursing facility and their ability to actually go out and get drunk again or go out and get involved in high-risk behavior is non-existent because they're completely dependent on the system to survive. Or they come in and they've got a severe head injury or they've been shot in the head. And, you know, they either don't survive or they're in a completely vegetative state. it seems like, especially the recidivism patients, their chances of it becoming more and more serious across the board seems real.
You would think that the first time you suffered from a gunshot wound, that would be the last time you would want to suffer from a gunshot wound.
You know, for a small percentage of people, it is a wake-up call. But for the vast number of people, especially those who are already addicted to drugs, addicted to alcohol, who are, you know, without hope in other parts of their lives, who are never given, you know, the opportunity to really get past the first injury and get out of the drugs, get out of the alcohol addiction or cycle, they come back time and time again. We see that quite often.
What do you think is the solution for us as individuals and as a society?
I think the problem is so complex now that there's no one solution. It's interesting because I heard a talk by a public health specialist who basically said that at this point it's not resources, the healthcare that are a problem, but the overall social infrastructure in general that we needed to start to fix. And this was an interesting perspective, especially with the patient population I deal with, in that we would need to really not only come up with programs to intervene after the patients have been injured, but things that could go into the community and result in preventive care, whether it be this expanding these programs for kids in high school and junior high school to kind of not get them into drugs and alcohol to start with, or putting a real inclusive effort to identifying those at risk for alcohol and drug addiction and give them true support and true programs that can help them get off and stay off of whichever substance they are addicted to. You know, and that in itself is going to be a multi-layer, multifunctional, tremendously costly but important intervention that we would need from a governmental standpoint. And so until we can take the beast by the horns from both ends, it's going to be the sort of thing where we're just going to be putting band-aids on the problem.
What role do you think poverty has in trauma and substance use?
It's interesting, this talk that I'm referring to that I heard a few weeks ago started out talking about the income level of the communities that this person was involved with. Poverty played a huge role in the percentage of people who showed up as traumatic injuries, who showed up as having not only acute problems but also chronic health problems. Anything that's going to help with the hopelessness of those communities, because people who live in poverty-stricken areas, they really have to work hard to be hopeful, and one of the ways they do that is by just numbing themselves. Poverty kind of feeds into it until we can support communities financially and give them a step up into a little bit less impoverished lifestyle, then the chances of them being able to live healthy lifestyles and not be turning to other incomes that may encourage drug and alcohol involvement, you know, we're not gonna win any elections that way until we give them the opportunity to actually have some hope facing the kind of lives and the struggles they're facing right now, working two and three jobs just to make ends meet.
It's interesting that the American College of Surgeons would be interested in promoting drug rehabilitation services, because we think of surgeons as really people who fix things after they're broken, and that seems much more of a public health, preventive services, primary care kind of thing.
The American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma are all trauma surgeons, and I think as a community, trauma surgeons have recognized that just putting bandages on and sewing people up doesn't keep them from coming back, and it's where we get back into that recidivism. Probably about a decade or so ago, some of the trauma surgeons sat down and said, you know, we really need to be thinking about injury prevention. And an outgrowth of that has been the observation that a lot of these folks are, you know, addicted to drugs and alcohol. It just followed suit and kind of made sense for alcohol and drug rehab and alcohol and drug intervention to become part of our injury prevention program in the Committee of Trauma.
Fortunately or unfortunately, you're unlikely to be out of a job very soon.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Are there any good habits that we should cultivate for injury prevention?
Ironically, I think one of my favorite trauma attendees when I was a resident was a fellow that believed very much in Zen Buddhism, and I think that his whole take on mindfulness and being aware was, you know, the key to everything, for what I can tell from an injury prevention standpoint. I think if we can teach our colleagues and our friends and our neighbors and our children to sort of be aware of what implications our actions take and the effect that it has not only on ourselves but on the world as a whole, that we can probably prevent a lot of the unnecessary injuries that are occurring right now, and definitely some of the drug and alcohol related injuries, because they won't have a venue for them anymore.
That's very well said. I thought you were going to say something about helmets and seatbelts and all, but that was much more profound.
Well, sometimes, you know, it's a lot easier to put a helmet on, but if you're not aware that, you know, you're riding on the wrong side of the street, the helmet doesn't do you a lot of good. So I think my professor, when I was a resident, probably taught me the crux of the matter, and not just to try and put the gear on, but to have the motivation behind protecting yourself. And I have to admit, he was definitely right.
Very well said. Do you have anything else you'd like to add about the role of alcohol, drugs, habits, addictions, and trauma?
Drug and alcohol use, especially drug and alcohol addiction, is an illness. I work and train medical students and residents now, and a lot of times they kind of give a persona to people that use drug and alcohols, and they sort of dehumanize those individuals. People in our culture and people who are involved in healthcare, I think it's very, very important for us to realize that anybody who has a drug or alcohol problem needs help on another level in addition to getting their lacerations sewn up and getting their injuries fixed, because they're going to continue to have problems if they are dealing with addictions.
Kelly, thank you for your time. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks.
Dr. Kelly Bullard, trauma surgeon on the east side of the San Francisco Bay. Dada da get at the gadig at the katarik at the katata tick at the gadig and again the dana da dinta cut. Dada da get at the gadidi dig at the canana, knock it at the katata, tak it at the katata, get at the gadidi, get at the canana, get at the katata, get at the gadak it at the gadik at the canak it at the katak it at the gada, da, da, tak it at the gadik at the canak it at the katak it at the gada, da, da, tak it at the gadik at the canak it at the katak it at the gada, da. Dr. Andrew Parker is a psychologist at the Employee Assistance Program at the University of California, San Francisco. I spoke with him in his office about addictions in the workplace. Dr. Andrew Parker, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
You're welcome.
Can you tell me about your role here at the Human Resources Department for UCSF?
Okay, well, our unit, which is called the Faculty and Staff Assistance Program, or FSAP, is the university's EAP, or Employee Assistance Program. I'm one of the senior psychologist here, and in addition to working with people on an individual basis for any variety of personal or work-related reasons, I also do a lot of organizational consulting, work with the Physicians Wellbeing Committee, the university's threat management team.
How do people's habits and addictions influence their occupations?
Certainly, substance abuse and addiction is one of the major underlying issues in any large organization. We're no different, I think, than large corporations and so on, in terms of the impact it can have on productivity, on morale, you know, on the people's coworkers. Because we have a medical center here, we have the added issue of patient safety. You know, when one of our care providers might have that kind of problem, there the impact can be huge. We have to do everything we can to identify these problems before they lead to something really serious.
How do you identify the problem?
I could describe the typical way that these things come to my attention, you know, which is usually somebody who works with the individual, typically, a manager or faculty chair or someone who is close enough to observe changes in their behavior, changes in personality, changes in performance. Somebody who, you know, once may have been pretty easygoing suddenly turns, you know, morose and withdrawn. Somebody who was always very on top of the details of their work starts, you know, dropping things, missing appointments, showing up late for work, calling in sick more often.
Do you find that it's generally people who are in managerial roles or supervisory roles, or do people who may be supervised by the person who's having the problem, do they feel confident enough to bring the problem to your attention?
That's a good question. In terms of who it affects, it's across the board. I don't think we have any one group or class of employment, you know, where you see it significantly more than others. I'm sure there's an effect where people who may have a superior who they suspect has such a problem are reticent to bring it forward. But that would just be a guess because we tend not to hear about those.
So in general, those people don't come forward to say anything?
While we certainly see a fair amount of people with those kind of problems here, we don't know how many we're missing. If you go by statistics, we're not seeing nearly as many people who have such problems here, you know, as actually need that kind of help.
What are the statistics?
You can look at different ways of slicing that pie. According to national statistics, and I think we're no different, about 3/4 of people who actively abuse some kind of substance, alcohol or drugs, are employed. The usual conception of people who are substance abusers as being unemployed or homeless is really not true. And the majority of the people who have active substance abuse problems who are working tend to be younger, early adulthood, maybe 18 to 25, somewhere in there. A lot of them aren't necessarily, you know, fit the classic definition of addiction or even necessarily the DSM diagnosis of substance abuse. A lot of them are binge drinkers or binge users, and most of them will do it on their own time, but a lot of them get carried away and it starts, you know, bleeding over into their work time, or they come to work not under the influence but impaired.
Hungover,
or maybe cognitively slowed, or judgment might be impaired. If they're abusing stimulants, they're often sleep deprived, their energy level is lower. And depending on the nature of their work, that can have a large or a very small impact.
Or they may be even suffering from some organic brain damage due to their drug use.
Right.
So what's the prevalence of the problem within this institution?
What we see here is pretty much, you know, within the norm, which is 5-6% of employees here have some kind of active substance abuse problem. Again, because we're dealing with a large medical care provider group, we're not just talking about alcohol and street drugs, we're talking about prescription medications.
Because they have easy access.
Yeah, they have the keys to the candy store.
Do you think physicians are at higher risk, or clinicians are at higher risk?
Not necessarily any more than the national averages. You know, I mean, there are certain specialties that you, if you break it down further, you'll see ones who are more at risk. You know, anesthesiologists, OBGYNs. In general, academic medicine just tends to be more of a stress, you know, machine and more of a pressure cooker. So you'll see that as, you know, a little higher than the average private practice physician. The main difference in patterns of abuse among physicians is that they also start abusing prescription drugs, benzodiazepines, opiates being the two big ones.
And they think they know the effects and that they can kind of manage it themselves.
Yeah, or at least they don't feel they're as vulnerable to those effects as the average person because of their training, their intelligence, things like that. But they're wrong.
I mean, one thing I noticed going through medical school is that a lot of my classmates drank a lot, and they did illegal drugs, and I'll just expose my naivety, but I was shocked. I was kind of under the impression that those of us who are studying medicine are kind of good kids and, you know, do the right thing and especially won't do anything illegal.
Well, first, I think it's important to note that people who are abusing substances in the workplace or while they're employed as adults, they probably started in adolescence. And these days, the age of first use is getting lower and lower. Middle school used to be high school. Now it's middle school.
Like age 12 and 13?
Like 10 or 11.
Wow.
They're already doing it by the time they hit medical school. Once they hit residency and they get the prescription pad, there's that problem. Except for the inclusion of prescription medications, most substance abusers in the medical field are no different than those out. That is, they have similar histories, similar patterns of use, but where the impact of their abuse is so much greater. And as you were saying, you know, earlier, they know better, or they should.
Or they think they know better.
Well, I mean, they have no excuse for not knowing what the physiological and psychological impacts of these things would be on them. Whether it's arrogance or naivete, they're certainly not using that knowledge to their own advantage.
The motive for use in some ways remains the same. There's pain, there's trauma, there's suffering that people are trying to relieve. And medical training in particular involves a great amount of suffering.
Right. There's the stress itself of being in medical training, the long hours, therefore lack of sleep, being under a constant microscope of evaluation, the whole self-medication phenomenon. For any number of reasons, it can be, you know, someone who's basically self-medicating because of something more physical, like a pain problem. But very often, you know, it's a mood problem, you know, or a self-esteem problem.
Exactly. I remember in my internship, the scheduling, you know, you're on day shift 2 days, and then on night shift, and then on the afternoon shift, and it just, the schedule made absolutely no sense. And I was not getting any sleep. And my attending well-meaningly suggested I take some Benadryl to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. And I did. And of course, I was drowsy in the morning and then took some Sudafed to wake up and then took Benadryl the next shift and Sudafed the next shift. And after about a week of this, I thought, wait a minute, this is not a good path to be taking. And so I stopped that and just managed through without any sleep.
Yes, when we're younger, you know, we tend to have more stamina. We can keep it up for a while longer, but everybody's got their limits.
Exactly.
Going by the statistics of how many physicians would be expected to have some kind of substance abuse problem at any given time in their life, the lifetime prevalence is 10 to 15%.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
So you think you're only identifying a third to a half?
Yeah, something like that.
So given the impact of impaired work performance in medicine, my proposition is that what we're expecting of human beings is beyond their capacity, and they'll find a method, if they have no other choice, to cope. And I think that in today's world, not only are occupational demands quite high, but also our life demands are quite high. Is there an institutional approach to modifying the demands?
I mean, that's an excellent question, and I agree with everything you said about the human impact of medical training. And, you know, and it's not that much different with nurses. They don't go through the same exact process, but, you know, they also have, you know, huge demands placed on them as well.
Or even beyond training, the whole academic environment, as you said, is a pressure cooker. Does it need to be a pressure cooker?
Well, I know that there are those who believe it is, that that's how you train people, you know, that you pile it on, that you immerse them in the process and so on. I mean, that is changing. And if I look at the physicians who I serve with on the well-being committee, for example, they all very much have this attitude that there has to be a more humane way. But I don't think they're in the majority yet.
What would it take to really bring about a sea change of belief and reprioritizing of our values in this regard?
There's one part of it that probably would have to happen on a national level, you know, where the AMA and, you know, similar organizations were involved. From the more local approach, I think it's up to each, you know, each training institution, you know, to reevaluate its methods and reconsider, you know, how you can get to the same goal, very well-trained physicians, but without sacrificing their emotional and physical well-being in the process. It's like an overheated engine. You know, you can keep putting oil in a car, but sooner or later, you're going to burn it out. I know from what we see here, you know, that a lot of them just start cracking under the strain. And they blame themselves, and they think they feel that they're weak or inadequate, and that it's their fault. Now, I will say that our graduate medical education office is one of the more humane ones. I think they're very interested in this. They've just actually created a well-being program for house staff, for our residents and clinical fellows, and are trying to be proactive about, you know, creating programs that can help them deal with these things.
What about the professors? They're kind of running the show, too.
They are.
And they're suffering from the pressure as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. There, I think, it's different in a way, because once people get to the point of actually having a faculty appointment here, and so they're juggling both academic and often clinical responsibilities, the unspoken expectation is that they're up to it and that they have nothing to complain about. And it's not until somebody actually starts showing the strain that somebody speaks up and says, hey, you might need some help.
But it's always about the individual needing help and not about the whole system needing help or about the whole culture needing to be changed.
In general, I'd say that's true. I mean, again, I think there are plenty of people who do recognize the systemic problems. But what it will take to get to critical mass, that's another question.
I mean, aren't we all collectively in charge of the systemic culture?
You'd think. But what I see happening is that people, starting early on in their training, get so used to the grind that, and to the assumption that that's how you get ahead, that's how you succeed, that they don't want to necessarily challenge it. I mean, some will, individuals will, but that kind of collective responsibility you're describing, it might be there in principle, but not in fact.
It's a little bit like swimming upstream to voice your stance when the whole entire world around you doesn't think the same way.
Right, exactly.
If we just step outside of UCSF and just look at work culture in general, do you think that in general occupational demands are at human capacity or beyond human capacity?
Well, I don't think I'm qualified to, you know, make too many generalizations about work culture in America in general. I mean, I will say that both here at UCSF and in my private practice, what I see are people who are generally overworked. whether they're self-employed or, you know, salaried, et cetera, and are just going paycheck to paycheck oftentimes. Even the people who would be considered successful, who are making a good income, are still constantly going less time for recreation, less time for well-being, less time for friends and family.
Less time for sleep and food.
Sleep and food, exactly.
So what's that about? I mean, obviously it's not that people aren't getting paid enough, because you're talking about people who are getting paid enough. Is it that they're spending beyond their means, or is it that the cost of living is too high, or is it that they're chasing a standard and a status of living? Or what's going on here?
All of the above. Yeah, I mean, and especially given the, you know, like the current, you know, trends in our economy, you have a lot more people who are working even harder to maintain a certain standard of living. You know, what you're talking about at one level are just human values, like what makes life worth living? Are we working to live or living to work? You know, that old conundrum.
How do we get to a place as individuals and as a society where we are working to live and enjoying our lives and feeling well?
I am a very strong advocate for mindfulness, and to me, that really is a key to the thing you're talking about here. I find that the more mindful somebody becomes, the more self-aware, the more they really are choosing to be present and to live in the present, the less they're able to hide these things from themselves or just go on automatic, you know, and ignore the effects of these things. The more that their values change, the more they find themselves wanting more work-life balance, for example, and refusing to settle for anything else. Once you get to a point where you cannot ignore the effects of these things on you, when you actually can see your suffering, then the motivation to change is organic. It's not theoretical. It's not because somebody else thinks it's a good idea. It's because you find that you simply can't sustain it anymore. Or even if you could, you don't want to.
Well said.
Thank you. If you're talking about social revolution, if you're even just social evolution, you still have to bring it down to an individual level at some point. You know, each one of us is completely responsible for our own existence, whether we like it or not. We're at a point where the kind of collective changes that you're talking about or suggesting, they're working, you know, in one direction, while there's also at least equally powerful forces towards maintaining the status quo and not raising these kind of questions and not developing that kind of self-awareness or mindfulness.
People are actually having to go in the opposite direction with working two jobs to maintain their rent and feed their children, etc.
What you say, I think, is central to this, which is that people will, faced with self-actualization choices versus survival and emotional and financial security choices, they're going to go for the latter.
So really what we need to do is raise wages and decrease cost of living.
That wouldn't hurt.
Great. I really appreciate talking to you. It's been an interesting conversation.
You're welcome.
Dr. Andrew Parker from the Employee Assistance Program at UCSF. Taka tunga kita taka tari kita na taka ta gain ta ta gain ta ta gain ta. Ms. Deborah Woodley from the Peer Assistance Program at a major transit agency in the Bay Area generously shared her experience and perspective as a recovering intravenous drug user, a mother of seven, a union organizer, and a peer counselor. Deborah, what is your role here at the Employee Assistance Program?
I work for the Peer Assistance Program for a major transit agency here in the Bay Area. We do assessments for any kind of work-related or home-related issues that might be affecting an employee's ability to come to work. We are the first person or the first leg on the rung that the employee sees. So they call us. We do an assessment, then decide what kind of services would best work for them, and then refer them out. Our services are completely voluntary. We are not the mandatory leg of employee services here. However, if there's an issue that a manager is noticing, for instance, with an employee, or if an employee has some discipline about to come down, oftentimes the union will call us in and say, listen, can you offer some services for this person? Because usually an employee is not having discipline issues unless something else is underlying that. Our position is that it doesn't do any good to suspend someone or to impose that kind of discipline without addressing the problem that caused the issue in the first place. One of the things that we provide, for instance, is substance abuse referral, treatment referral. If substance abuse is now affecting their ability to come to work, if they aren't showing up, if they've got absences or not showing up, not calling, work performance issues, oftentimes we find that it may be substance abuse related.
So what has your experience been in dealing with substance abuse in the workplace?
Well, let me say, first of all, that I'm a recovering person myself. I've worked for this transit agency for 6 years, went into treatment myself through the Employee Assistance Program, and got clean and sober, been clean and sober for 21 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So in that sense, I have some kind of on-hand personal experience. If a person's having a substance abuse problem and it's showing up at work, it's pretty severe. It's usually one of the last places that it shows up. Shows up at home, shows up with friends next. By the time it's showing up in the workplace, it's pretty severe.
Would you be willing to share your own personal experience?
Sure. I started work for the transit agency in 1981, had a substance abuse problem at that time, was able to kind of show up, do the initial interview and be in good shape for that. Got to a point where I knew that my attendance, the way that I was showing up and not showing up for work, was going to cause a severe problem for me. Called the Employee Assistance Program. They then referred me to a treatment program, went into the treatment program. I'm an active member of Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous, and it worked for me and has worked for me for 21 years. I'd have to say that by the end of my addiction, it was really, really an issue for me at work, at the very, very end of me even showing up for work impaired.
You were coming to work intoxicated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, showing up for work. Not only intoxicated, but feeling the effects of the use from perhaps the night before or for the day before or the weekend or whatever, maybe not having used immediately before having come to work. The absences were so much that I didn't have any more to say, well, I got to call in sick because I can't go. I'm too high. And I would go. And I realized that I couldn't continue to do that, that something was really going to happen. But also, too, that I needed to do something to address that in a voluntary way because I knew that if I continued to take off, I was going to lose my job. You know, it's a pretty good incentive.
So basically you ran out of sick leave.
Exactly. Ran out of sick, vacation, floating holidays, and was actually at the point where I was showing up on what we call the doctor's list all the time. That is, every time you call in sick, you got to bring in a doctor's note. Well, it gets to be kind of difficult to explain to your doctor why it is that you're needing a doctor's note every other day or every 2 days. Or actually, you know, I'd have to say that my back was kind of against the wall.
Did your doctor suspect anything?
No. They typically just don't ask. Even if they do suspect something, they don't say anything. I can't imagine, since I was an IV drug abuser, I can't imagine that people didn't see the marks on my arms. But no, they never did say to me, you know, what is that for? How did that, you know, why do you have that there? Or what's going on with you? Or never, never once. And basically what I was supposed to do was to relieve another employee. I was there to relieve another driver. And he looked at me. He knew. And he never said a word either. He never said, I'm not giving you this bus. And I know that it was difficult for him. And there was no one here on site, like, for instance, for my manager to refer me to and say, listen, you got all these absences. Maybe you might need to go talk to the peer assistance program and see. Been not saying that I necessarily have a substance abuse problem, because that's not always what it is. Never had that happen either.
May I ask you what your position was? Were you a driver? Or
an operator. That's right. I was a driver and had been driving for 6 years when I got into recovery. Yeah, that's a pretty scary thought. I mean, you know, it's scary for me now to think that there were a couple of times that I was out behind the wheel with people on the street, myself, people on a bus, at risk and feeling like I didn't have any place to go.
What do you mean you didn't have any place to go?
Feeling like that I was going to be judged. Wasn't going to go to my manager and say that's what was going on. And I didn't feel like there was anybody like me that I could talk to. That's one of the things that this particular program, the Peer Assistance Program, provides, is we make sure that folks know that we're available to them, that we're staffed by people who are in recovery, who have recovered from addiction, who worked for the agency, who've been around for a long time, to provide that incentive to say, look, nobody's going to judge you here. We've all been there, and we made it. We're a success, you know. So at the time, I didn't feel like that at all. I knew about the Employee Assistance Program because there was a man there who I was aware of that I knew. And so I decided that I would give that a whirl, that it was better than taking a chance on being fired. Yeah.
And that worked.
It worked. But you have to realize, too, at that point, I'd had 22 years of active addiction from the time I was 16 till I was 38. It was amazing that that could go on for that long without someone saying to me, you know what, something's not right here. I've got 7 children, so I've been seen by doctors quite a bit. To never have a doctor say, okay, something's not right here.
Not one doctor.
Not one doctor. Never.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it is. It's also scary. And it talks, I think, about the level of training and understanding that we have in our society as it relates to substance abuse. There's 10% of the population that have this disease, the disease of addiction.
In all those 22 years, did you ever feel like telling your doctor?
No, I didn't trust him.
Did you feel like telling anybody?
Yeah, I always felt like something needed to be done. But as is the case, I think, with a lot of addicts, it's difficult to see how you can live your life without that, without drugs. First of all, I love my children, and I wanted to provide a home for them. And then having this job, which was a really good job, still is, not wanting to lose that job gave me the impetus to say, okay, well, something else has to happen here. Thank God, was able to talk to the Employee Assistance Program, was able to then begin to see a way to be in the world without drugs and alcohol. And now I can't imagine a world where I was any other way.
That's great.
Yeah, it is. And it's something that I'd love to see everyone who's suffering from this come to. But unfortunately, I don't know if you know, there's a third of us who get clean and sober through treatment, and a third of us who, for some reason or other, just stop, and a third of us who never make it.
Who die because of their addiction?
Who die, either die or end up in jail, or as in AA, they say jails, institutions, and death. And in the workplace, it's an excellent opportunity to intervene because you have this kind of this hook for the person, especially if there's some discipline attached to it. If the manager's saying, listen, if you don't get your absence stuff together, you know, next time you come in here, you're up for termination. It's a pretty good impetus to get a person to try to open their mind and see that there may be a different way to do this. Yeah.
What do you think about the role of drug screening?
Yeah, you know, it's a well-meaning program. My issue with it is that it does not address alcoholism. If a person has an alcohol problem, they can be tested lots and lots of times just for drugs, never show up for alcoholism. Then the other thing is that I think it gives the general public the idea that the real problem in transit is drugs and alcohol, when in fact it's more really about the schedules are too tight. It's about an operator working here in San Francisco, can't afford to live here, living in Antioch, for instance. So it takes him an hour and a half to get to work, an hour and a half to get home. He's at work for 10 hours. Then he's got to go back to work. So he's maybe getting 6 hours sleep, 5 hours sleep. So we're talking about fatigue being one of the issues. And I think it really kind of masks some of the real issues that need to be addressed. But I do think for the individual sometimes, and you'll have people who tell you this, that it was the best thing that ever happened to them. They tested positive. They went into this program. And again, they had a real incentive. It showed them that there is, in fact, another way
what I'm understanding you saying is that you, in some ways, see the value of a urine toxicology screening program for illicit drugs. It does catch some people who then benefit. But you would also like to see some kind of screening implemented for alcohol use, because you think that actually alcohol use is a bigger problem.
They do breathalyzers, but here's the way it's set up for the Department of Transportation, okay? It's like 25% of the transit agent's population is tagged for random drug testing, okay? Something like 10% or 15% of those people are flagged for alcohol testing. So if my name gets called and I go in for a random test, I will definitely be screened for drugs. I may or may not be screened for alcohol. My thing is why not do both to everybody each time? The breathalyzer's cheaper. It's easier. You know, what's the disconnect there? I think it's a smoke screen. And this may be a political statement here.
Excellent.
I think it's a smoke screen that says to folks, the biggest problems are related to some kind of drug and alcohol use by operators or by commercial drivers, when in fact, it's working conditions that are the biggest issues in terms of accidents and those kinds of things. And those statistics don't come out, or they do, but they're kind of under the radar. Of course, they aren't as glamorous as somebody having an accident for alcohol and drugs, as opposed to, you know, they just plain fatigue.
Well said, because I think that is the other part of what you were trying to say. There is the structural issue around the economy and the productivity expectations that is contributing to work-related accidents.
Yeah, I definitely think that. And I think the desire to address substance abuse in the workplace is definitely, definitely needed. But at the same time, I don't want to see it overshadow what's actually causing the majority of workplace accidents.
Then there's also the created reality of unaffordable housing and wages that are inconsistent with affording to live in the locality of the workplace.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So either wages have to come up, or housing prices have to come down, or productivity expectations need to be changed.
Or some conglomeration of all of those.
Yeah, actually, we had a previous episode about sleep deprivation where we touched on some of that and how fatigue and sleep deprivation causes as much impairment in driving as substance abuse or intoxication. Yeah. How much do you think work-related stress, productivity expectations, or even sleep deprivation contribute to the actual substance abuse problem?
I think quite a bit. I also think people who used to use some substance that maybe wouldn't impair them as much as alcohol are now using alcohol more to relieve that stress. So, for instance, if I'm a guy who smokes a joint on the weekend to have a time with my buddies, now I can't do that. So now I'm having beers, because some kind of way people are going to do what they normally do to relieve stress. Now the substance changes. Alcohol as a stress reliever, I think, is much, much worse, can be much more detrimental to a person physically in terms of their ability to come back, to show up at work that next Monday unimpaired. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a very, very dangerous drug for people who are operating machinery, like 50-ton buses and big rig trucks.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Does this transit agency have mandatory random drug screening?
Yes, they do. And if you're receiving federal funds, you have to be a part of the Department of Transportation random drug test.
So if you were in charge of the world...
Sometimes I think I am now.
And you could run things according to your own priorities. How would you prioritize the workplace and society for the benefit of the workers and the public?
The fact that I used to be a union representative. Now, you know, my mom was also a union organizer. You have to take that from that standpoint. My first priority with workers is that the workers have to have some stake in keeping things going. And it doesn't seem to me that we have that, other than some people giving us some kind of lofty idea that we should feel some kind of work ethic because it's great to work. Safety would definitely be one of the top priorities. We need to be able to do this thing called work and still have another life. As of late, in the last maybe 10, 15 years, there's this idea in the West, or at least in the United States, that somehow our families don't matter. They're kind of like the secondary thing, and these jobs, these things, are supposed to be what defines us. That's a big problem. It's a big issue, because if you don't have a really strong base, if you aren't coming from a place where you're nurtured and loved and you're giving that back, then you can't possibly bring a good work day to your place of work. There's no way you can do that. Let the worker know, okay, we know this is just your place to come, you know, earn money and contribute to the community or whatever, but you've got to have that place to come from in the morning so that no matter what, when you get out there on the road, you know that back where you are, back where you live, people will be glad to see you when you get home.
Very well said. It also helps to have people be glad to see you when you come to work, too.
Yeah.
What does it look like for workers to have a stake in the safety and productivity of their workplace?
Definitely looks like the workplace feels like they have a stake in you. It's a wonderful thing for an employee to feel like the employer gives a damn about what's happening with them. Physically, mentally. We in this country need to take a look at what's happening in Europe. People are given much more time off, much more leisure time, much more time to spend with their families. Also, the employer having the idea, okay, if I'm in this partnership, that's what it would look like, a partnership. We're going to be in a win-win situation. Longevity, okay? You're not burning them out. You know, 20 years, we're all flying rig, just counting the days to get out the door.
That sounds like family values, actually.
Yeah. it does.
And I would also add to time given to family is also time given for creativity, for people to dance and make music and paint and sing and be in nature and really have free mind time.
Yeah, love that. That's really a good point. That is really a good point. I'm a person that everywhere I go, there's music with me. I can't imagine. You know, I think it's one of the gifts that God gave us. You know, we're as human beings are the only animals who are able to do that with other instruments, you know, to make that incredible, incredible sound. I have just begun to really get into art and what that means, the expression of emotion that can come from that. In this culture, in this country, we don't value that. We don't look at those things as valuable, and they probably are the most valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll just tell you about the elephants that are painting in Thailand.
Oh, that's right.
So it's us and the elephants.
That's right. I actually did see a thing about that also, yeah.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. This has been fun.
I think that your perspective is really valuable for us to really consider for making our choices and how we want our workplaces and our society to look like.
Thanks.
Ms. Deborah Woodley from the Peer Assistance Program at a major transit agency in the Bay Area.
Din, din, na, di, na. Dagena dati dati dagena tagetina gena ta 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 na da 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 na ta na ta na.
Our concluding poem. If I were to write a poem like Rumi, I would ask you why you are twisting your life into a task. I would request you to put away all that feels like work and to fire the businessman and the politician from the negotiations of who and what you can love and how much. I would implore you to dance and sing with drunken abandon and to kiss the ground in a thousand different ways. I would beseech you to forget the names of your gods, but like a laughing madman, refer to every living stone and breathing moment as your beloved.
Neijing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander. Website set up and design, Srinivas Pakkanati and Dirk Polson. tabla and manjira played by J.C., bass guitar by Pedro Ordóñez, drum set by G.C. Garcia, compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary, concluding poem written by J.C., distributed by Gypsy Jays Productions, found at gypsyjays.net, gypsyjays.net. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org.